She just died. I was kneeled down near her, and I wanted really to keep the promise. When I got up, I wanted to start running, and I was shot. I was shot in my leg, and I saw it was torn out, and the blood would start running. And also, it was scratched my head, and my head, and my head started bleeding, and my hair. When I ran for a little bit, but I felt I couldn't. I returned to my mother, and I just lay on the top of her. The days were short because it was late in fall. It was very cold, almost freezing. When the shooting subsided, and they did a marvelous job, because from this ghetto, you wouldn't believe it, only I and one more person survived. What they did, they came with lots of wagons and sleds, and they collected the dead people. They threw us in. I played dead. And two people would just throw the dead people in the wagons and some other means. They brought us to the big pit, which it was very large. It was open. And they start throwing the bodies in the pit. It took several hours until they cleaned and did and brought everybody dead, and they brought us in to the pit. When I was thrown in there, I felt I was alive. I also felt some other people were moving. But I lay there. When everything stopped, it was very dark, and everybody left. They didn't close the pit because apparently they thought they will still collect people. I decided I will try to crawl out of there. And I first crawled, I was in the middle. I first had to crawl to one of the sides. And from there, I don't know, apparently my will was so strong that I managed to crawl out of there. But I was so soaked in blood, and my shoes came off. I was barefoot. My hair were all soaked in blood, my clothes. And I got out of there, and I start running. I didn't know where, but from far away, I saw light, and apparently it must have been a small farm. I ran to this house, I knocked at the door, and a woman came out. She saw me, and apparently she must have thought I'm a devil or something, because you could imagine. And it was so cold that my hair became like icicles, like red icicles. And she saw me, and I asked her if she could give me something to put on my feet.
But anyway, he let me go. And then we had the first selection for the gas chambers. And we had to jump across a ditch and land on the sandy side of the ditch.
Well, like a fitness test?
Yeah, I suppose. And it wasn't even a very wide ditch. And most of the other girls made it. In fact, all of them, I think, that were in my block, I fell in. So the next thing I knew, I was pulled out and I was put together with other poor skeletons to be sent to the gas chamber as well, to block 24, you know, the, where you had to wait until they had enough for the gas chambers. Again, I was saved at the last minute, and it was that woman, that SS, the head woman in the SS staff quarters, and she had promised my mother to get me.
And we were sent to Auschwitz then. They transported us. We walked, which was just about 15 or 20 minutes walk, I think, from Birkenau to Auschwitz. It was very close. Also, when I was in Birkenau, they chose us to work one morning also. And we did that for about 2 weeks. We had to go out and make trenches, you know, like they, we had to go, and then we had walking to some place, and with dogs about us. And we had one lady who was something on the side of the road where we were walking, and she pulled something from that, and the guard sent a dog after her. And on the other side, on the left-hand side, there was a pond, water or something. And the dog just put, we never saw her again, the dog pushed her in there or whatever. It was, we never saw that woman again. And she had two children, I know she was very worried about, but of course they went the other way, so she didn't never know what happened to them. But we never saw her again. It was a big, tall woman. It's funny how you, some things you don't remember, and some things you see so vividly in front of you.
And we were taken to a ramp and ordered to undress the shirts, take off the shirts and pants and so on. And I still had a shirt, and one high-ranking officer, and to me he looked at the same like that Geth von Płaszów, but I don't know, I'm not sure it was him, but I don't think so. He stuck his pistol here and tore the whole shirt off. And we were loaded on the train, and we arrived in Auschwitz. Oh, I forgot, in Modorówka, came to Siedmia a group of a transport from Tarnów. And they took out something like 500 to 600 women and men, and they took them out to Modorówka in the field, and they executed them. And the bonfire, you could see 3 or 4 days burning. I'm sorry that I forgot about that. And however, in the way, when we came to Auschwitz, there was a selection. And some of the group were put on trucks. You could see the trucks steaming, but we were too ignorant to know whether they were. These were gas trucks. And never saw them again.
What did you know about Auschwitz when you first got
Nothing.
There?
Nothing. They were in a barrack, contained in a barrack. They came in from Tarnów. And they took them out to a place they called the Modorówka. It was outside Ishemia. And the Ukrainian guards killed them all. Then they came back to camp, and they grabbed people. Matter of fact, I was grabbed, but I gave a twist and managed to run under the bunk. They took out 10 people to work and load lumber, and they took them out. A couple of hours later, you could see a flame shooting up into the air, and that was for a couple, 2 or 3 days at least going. And when they brought back the clothing, this druggist recognized the wife's shoes. So it was a pretty bad feeling in the camp with those people that lost their relatives with this execution. What I heard that, I don't know how true it is, that was Hitler's birthday. That was a gift for him. There are 3 ships, and the ships were loaded with prisoners, and a lot of people from First Group were on it. And they torpedoed one ship, and then the others, they pulled the plugs so the ship should sink. And there were some Norwegian prisoners, and they knew how to block it up. And when the ships turned over on the side, they were laying right on top of the ship on the belly, like. And some SS came back. They saw them alive. They started shooting them. Somebody bought a cabinet or whatever. A prisoner got inside and got out. That night, everyone in the camp, Christian and non-Christian, had to line up, and they opened on both sides, bursts of fire and shooting over the head. It just was wild. And near the end, we got a warning. If somebody ever will escape, every 10th of you will die. You are responsible for your inmates. That's one brutality. In the previous camp, like in Romanov, that was at Commandant Oberscharführerscheid. He was so sadistical that no one can even imagine. I can't even describe. Like when they took us out, forced us to go under the water and firing into the water on top like somebody throws pebbles. And most people would not have survived if they wouldn't have been young and good lungs to absorb all that. There were all kinds of, let's say like in Stalova Vola. There was one man, he was a Talmud study student. They forced him to open a grave. It was on a Sunday. And they finally told him, when it was open, they told him to sit down in there. He did. And they asked him to lay down. He refused to do so. So start kicking him over the head. And we saw it. And finally, with the boots, they kicked the dirt in and over his face after that. And he was jumping back and forth. One guard would stand in the front of the body, and one would stand on his knees until the body starts functioning. And if you don't call this brutality, what is? For no reason at all, just for entertainment. This happened to be on a Sunday. The reason I know it's Sunday, because we were trying to wash ourselves. We had no time to wash in the middle of the week. Or the guards would take, like my brother that was shot. I have a suspicion that that guard was part of it. We were sitting near the barn. There was a well. We were sitting all around, and all of a sudden a guard came over with a bag, grabbed my brother and told him to mix the thing and to eat it. It was manure. And my younger brother, he happened to be pretty strong, similar to this guy here. And he gave him a push, and he slipped, and he got away. Shortly after that, he was shot to force people to eat manure. So these kind of sadistical things, or let's say, I once witnessed a woman was brought to the field that we were settled in the swamp, brought her over, and that was not the SS, that was not the Wehrmacht, one of the gendarmes. And he walked down the side, and she fell and started kissing his boots to leave her. It looked like she begged him to leave alone. As she climbed up, he took his pistol and fired a shot into the head. And there were some Polish, they call them eunuchs, that shovels and immediately undressed her, and they even examined the slip and the blouse, and they buried her right there and then. Here he is, a walking human being, maybe in the 20s, in the early 30s, and all of a sudden, those guys have their clothing already, and they kick into a hole there in a swamp. There was a lot of brutality, or taking a kid, cracking the head against the cement, all kinds. The more criminal, the more advanced they were in rank. Like that Mo. He didn't do any harm before. When he executed the 10 people, because one hung themselves in the enforcing group, he shot 10 people by himself. One Hungarian Jew hung himself in the coal mine. And of course, one shift had to dynamite the coal for the other shift to be able to take it out. And when the dynamite exploded and knocked him off the rope and buried him under the coal. In the morning, he ordered 10 people to lay down and he executed them. Middle of the night, he fired like a wild animal into the barrack of the shift. He injured quite a few people. Shortly after that, they recalled him and made him head of the crematoria in Auschwitz. So in other words, the more brutality you displayed, the higher ranking you became. But there's no end with the brutalities that you can describe. I remember during the resettlement, there was a man, he was pretty heavy. We called him the Grobe Alte, in other words, the thick, his name was Alte. Soldier put him against a tree, fired 5 shots, we heard, and he stood. Then he fired another shot as we walked by. He started slipping down and sitting against a tree. And finally, he took a hand of sand and threw it in his mouth. And blood would come out with his sand. Finally, Father gave another shot, and by that time, we were already close by. He fell over on the side. And that was for no reason whatsoever. In other words, that man was not useful for anything.
We were ushered again to some trucks, and we ended up going on foot out of the trucks up the hill to Mauthausen. We arrived in Mauthausen into Quadrangle. It was up the hill facing 4 ovens. And we knew there were ovens, and they told us there were ovens. But they also explained that unfortunately we have to wait because a courier went to somewhere into Germany to get Cyclone B. They ran out of Cyclone B.
Did you know what that was for?
Yes, to destroy our bodies after we were shot. Cyclone B. We knew about Cyclone B, that they were necessary for the burning of the bodies. What that Cyclone B did to the bodies, I don't know to this day, but that much we did know. They were probably shooting us first because they were walking. It was like a huge wall, fairly wide, because they were walking all around us. And that's where the news came from, that, sorry, we have to wait. They can't start shooting till the Cyclone B will arrive. But in the meantime, they were throwing to us, like to animals, chocolate, figs, cocoa in tins, sardines, in a small quantity. But we stood in front of the oven, and yet we bent to pick up whatever the food was.
I looked toward, I don't know what direction, where we were guided. There were a big fire, like a bonfire, like a Christmas tree. Always comes back to me like that. And little babies' faces twisted in pain, looking at me, and little arms and legs hanging out of the flame. And then, because many of the children were thrown into the flame, grabbed from the mother's arm and thrown into the flame. But naturally, we didn't know where we are. And then some of the girls around me started to scream that they are burning us alive. And then we realized that the stench what we feel is the burning flesh of human and the fat of human and so on. That's what happened in the first night. When we came to the barracks, the girls started to, I didn't speak for 3 weeks, not one word after that scene. And when the girls came into the barracks where we were sent, they were screaming and crying, where are our parents and sisters and brothers? And one of the SS men walked up and with the rubber stick pointed to the sky and said, look up, what do you see? And what we have seen, very heavy black smoke covering the whole sky. And he was laughing. He said, there are your sisters and parents, and there where you are going. And he turned around and walked away laughing. Even today, many times I hear the laugh. That was my first day in Auschwitz.
When the first day I arrived to Dachau, I saw people coming home from work. All of them, they looked like dead people, all of them. I asked them, what are you working? He said, we have to carry 50 kilograms cement off our shoulder and to go 24 steps to the mixing machine. And I said to myself, 50 kilograms is 100 pounds, and I'm 50 years old, how will I be able? And I said, if you cannot carry it, he said, no problem. We have two choices. If for any reason you fall on your knees, that you cannot go up with the 50 kilogram cement, they get the order, or throw you in the mixing machine alive, or carry you down and to put you one of each other. I said, Joshua, you cannot afford this luxury thing, but you will have to do it. And the first day, I couldn't go up on my feet. I went on my knees, but I carried the 50 kilogram cement. And who couldn't carry the 50 kilogram cement, listen carefully. It was two-way, or they gave the order, what I got, this order, not once. Put them up, throw them alive in the mixing machine. Or the order was to carry them down and to put them one of each other, and all of them, they were alive. And then I made a picture. Joshua, you cannot be carried down here because all the people in the evening, when you got the order to put them on the trucks to deliver them in the crematorium, they were all alive. They were asking for help. I decided if I, for any reason, would be not able to go up with 50 kilograms cement, I will not wait for the verdict, carry him down. I will jump myself in the mixing machine. And I was happier to put people in the mixing machine because I know one day I will jump after them. Because in the mixing machine, you suffer 30 seconds. But then they could suffer 1 or 2 days alive without help. No Kaiser, no Cedars-Sinai. And one more later, I could carry 2 sacks cement, 100 pounds.
And so did you put, did you put them in the mixing machine? Did you put them in the mixing machine?
The mixing machine? I saw it the whole day, 10, 12 hours. I saw it. I throw in people with these 2 hands. I picked them up. They couldn't go up. They dropped for any reason. I picked them up with the happiness because I know that I will follow them one day. To prepare yourself is easier than you get surprised. I know that I never wanted to get it up. When I put them in, I know they will suffer 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and that's it. But this was the order.
What was the machine precisely?
They were building an underground runway. You need a massage?
No.
Don't get scared for my story. This is not a story.
Tell me, what was the mixing machine?
The mixing machine, we were building an underground runway for the Messerschmitt, what they manufactured. Everything still exists. I was there with my children. Not the whole, it still exists. Tens of thousands of people died there, and tens of thousands of people worked there. And I was one of them. The camp was, one was Mühldorf, where I slept, where I worked. And the other side of the runway airport was Waldlager. But tens of thousands of people, 24 hours a day, were there. It exists until today.
So the mixing machine did what?
A mixing machine. Did you ever see a mixing machine? Go to La Brea here in Los Angeles. Go ask the owner, I want to see how the mixing machine. You will see, you put in cement, water is coming automatically, and trucks are coming, they're filled up, and they take it to building. This wasn't building for killing prisoners. This was built to manufacture mixing cement.
So I need to be clear. Inmates who were going to die or had already died were thrown into the mixing machine.
Or you dry or you alive. No middle section. People were in the mixing machine. They got in pieces. You couldn't find them in building. The mixing machine goes to the where they run the ready-made cement. Did you ever see a mixing machine? If no, go to look. They will show you. If no, go to the trucks where they deliver mixing cement, and you will see how they make the roof or everything. Mixing machine. It's a very simple procedure.
And were the SS involved in that process of?
No. This was management, capos. I saw soldiers. But who looked around? You don't have time to look around. You did your job. You became a robot. I know I have to go. I have to go up and I have to come down. Then I know I go home to sleep and I got food. No middle way. And you said, how could you do such a thing to pick up somebody? I know that I will do it myself, nobody will do it for me. Because to carry down all the people, when I came, I got the order to put them on the truck and they delivered it and truck to the crematorium. Most of them, they were alive. As you became an animal, life of my life, of his life, it doesn't matter. Normal people cannot do it. But you are a slave. Can you imagine to pick up a person, throw them in a mixing machine? You have to be a real murderer. And to behave like an animal, to go in a gas chamber, to bring bones and put them on a stretcher. Can you imagine a 15 years old child? If you tell me, I would listen to you, but I would never believe. And I say it again. And I don't believe it's whatever you are doing with this collection of the Holocaust survivors. And I'm not angry of the deniers either. If I don't believe, how they can believe?
Almost 75 years later, Herman and Joshua are both together in the gallery tonight, seated side by side, here in the home of American freedom. Herman and Joshua, your presence this evening is very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
And I just saw this. There's no end to it. It came to a point where you really didn't care. As long as I don't have to go anymore to work, I don't care. Am I dead? Am I alive? I didn't probably think in those terms, but I just didn't care anymore. I just gave up. In the inside of me, my brothers warned me from that. And the next day, I went to the infirmary and I reported sick. And they took me in there. At least for me, it was a relief. I don't have to go to work. So when my brothers found out that I'm in the infirmary, there was all kinds of way how to, you know, send messages. They came running every day to the window there, couldn't come in because it was all gated up. And they begged me I should get out of there. And I really felt so miserable. I was like thankful to God that I can have a little rest there. I don't have to go to work. It sounds funny right now, but to get a little relief of not having to go to work, and I got at least my cup of coffee in the morning and a piece of bread, that it was like a whole new world opened up for me. Except the danger that my brothers knew is that every time when this place filled up, which took maybe, I don't know, 1,000, maybe 1,500 people, they used to come with big vans and they used to load all these people up and they used to take them to the crematorium to gas them and get rid of them. I was too stupid at that time, or losing my mind even to think of such a thing, and probably so degraded by now and so far not caring that it just didn't matter. Probably the same way as the other guy had the stamina to run to the wires and take his life, that was my way of saying enough is enough, I can't do it anymore. And then one day, they were emptying out that infirmary, and everybody had to go to the yard outside. Of course, that was the day that they were going to get rid of him. So as everybody walked out, there were two guys, also people who were from concentration camp, asking you, what's the matter with you? So everybody was telling him what's wrong with them. When they asked me what's wrong with me, I told them that I get up in the night and I'm dizzy and I have to hold up to a wall or to something until I steady myself, and otherwise I feel like falling down. So I heard one telling the other guy that he thinks that I have typhus. So one guy said, you know what, you go back inside on the bunk, lie down. I did. In the afternoon, I fell asleep. It was in the morning, I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock or so. In that afternoon, I got up. The whole place is empty. There's nobody there. And I asked the guys who are in charge, the Stubendienst there. I says, where is everybody? So he looks at me. He says, you don't know? I says, no, I don't know. He says, they took them all to be gassed. So it like shook me up. And then I asked the guy,
whether he could go. Yeah, in the evening, my two brothers don't show up. They don't show up because later on they told me one of them had a Jewish calendar somehow smuggled in. He already put down the date of my death because they heard the whole place is emptied out, so I'm gone too. So they put down the date when I died, I mean, in case they ever come out, so they have at least a date. And I went over to the guy there and I tell him, listen, I'll give you my bread, my ration. Go tell my brothers and ask them why they're not coming. I didn't realize it, that they already know that I'm not here anymore. So he took my bread and he never went to notify them. Well, these blocks were not any further away than here houses are from each other. So next day I begged him and I cajoled him again and again and again. So in the evening, he finally took away against my ration, or the additive that was with the ration, maybe a piece of horse salami or whatever they gave you. And he went and he notified them. And I remember like today when my two brothers came to the window, it like, they look at somebody who just got up from the dead and they started crying and begging him and say, get out of here, get out of here. I says, I feel a little better now, I'm gonna tell him and I'm gonna try to get out. And sure enough, the next day I really, you know, picked up a little strength and I was feeling a little bit better. There was like a miracle that this guy takes my pulse and he says, I think he has the typhus, and he sends me back to the like an angel showed up there. I mean, if I think back today, it's like a guardian angel showing up and says, you go back inside. If I would have stayed outside, I would have really been gone. And the next day I told the guy that I feel much better and they let me go out there again. Then I joined my brothers again in the detail.
And I drank that water, and until the guard said, you know what you've drunk, girl? That's from the swamps, and the swamps make very good graves. Anyway, I developed typhoid fever, and I didn't know, but I had a very high fever, I was taken to the so-called hospital, and they put me into a ward with a mixed ward, which had clean sheets and good blankets and white bread and jam on a table until the doctors came around. And then they identified by the red spots on my stomach that I had typhoid fever, and I was drugged into another ward. And there I was more or less left to die with everybody else. I was put on a bunk bed with another Greek girl who died in her sleep. With her arms around me, we were trying to keep each other warm. And then I was unconscious again, and the doctors, prison doctors, came along and said of me, she's dead, you can throw her in the corner, she won't feel anything. And I didn't. And I was in the corner. And it was one of those sensations you sometimes hear about, that I looked down on me from the top of that bank and I saw a rat running over my leg. And somehow that put me back in my body. And somehow I managed to get up onto an empty top. And then Dr. Mengele came. And the nurse who was there hit me because she didn't believe me that I had got up there on my own. She said, you were dead or all but dead. Who put you there? And she hit me and hit me until Dr. Mengele kicked the stool she was standing on from under her. And then he looked up at me and he said, aren't you the nurse from Berlin? I thought I sent her on a malaria transport somewhere. I said, no, that was my mother. That's another story, but it's getting too late.
When I watched those Germans walking amongst us, the women, I must have been a great observer, because I remember they went around immaculately dressed with their boots, which is one of my nemesis. Boots really destroy me when I hear that sound. I can almost identify it very clearly. Even today, I hear this kind of sound. It gives me the chills. And they walked around immaculately dressed with their pokes, and some of them wore hats, those German hats, those lovely, their regalia, so to speak, and how they treated the women. I remember watching that there was some kind of a counter there in the middle when we went through after we were separated, and I don't know, we were changed and dressed. How I remember this one German, and this woman was naked naturally, how he made her bend over that counter, whatever it was, and took the poke and poked her in her butt, and had somebody look into her butt to see whether she had some jewelry inside her rectum.
So I took risk every whatever he sent me to the kitchen to bring the special food in exchange for the jewelry that he stole from the bread from the prisoners. I remember one fact, I was caught one time by the Lagerführer, where he was, I think, Lagerführer, you know, there was many Lagerführer there. And when I was caught, I dropped everything, started running away. So then I jumped out the window from the kitchen. In the back of the barracks were piles of dead people, skeletons, they called them Muslimmen. And as I was running, he started shooting after me. So I remember jumped in underneath the pile of the bodies, and I was hiding underneath there. I don't know how many hours I was laying there, but I do know the machine gun, they were shooting, the bodies were jumping. And as they're jumping, I was deeper. So he thought I'm dead. And after a while, I dug myself out and I came back. Well, this is one case.
So my father decided they're going to hide us in these stables. They used to have holes in the ground because there was no refrigeration. So anything that you could play spoil, they used to put it in the hole in the ground, it's cooler. So he decided he's going to hide us in one of these holes. So it was me, my cousin, she had a 7-month-old baby, and another kid. They put us in one of those holes. They put boards on top and they put hay over it, so it shouldn't be noticeable there's something there. And then we were there for a while, and my cousin that had a 7-month-old baby had asthma, and she had trouble breathing. She decided she was going to open up the hole to get a little fresh air. And while she was doing it, a couple of German soldiers came in to look if anybody was hiding there, and they saw the hole, the board there, you know, uncovered a little. So they came over and then covered the hole completely, and they hollered, "Juden raus," means Jews out, in a loud voice. And my cousin, 7-month-old baby, started to cry, got scared. So one of the German soldiers grabbed the baby from my cousin's arms and threw it up into the air. Anybody knows what a bayonet is? Okay? A bayonet is a big knife that's kept, they keep it in front of the rifle when you fight in close combat. So he threw up the baby in the air, 7-month-old baby, and caught it on the bayonet, on the knife, and started twirling it around like that. The blood was gushing out from the baby, right? And they were laughing, having fun killing the baby.
The American population at that time had a lot of German people in it. 30-50% of the population had relations back to Germany. So there had to be this very clever propaganda campaign. It's known today as babies on bayonets. So if you have no interest in World War I, but you think it's interesting to study propaganda so you don't get fooled again, then type it into your favorite search engine, babies on bayonets, World War I. You'll see hundreds of different posters where the Germans are bayoneting babies, and it brings about emotions, and it doesn't give you the details of anything, and emotions drive wars, not facts.
And when they were doing killing the baby, I decided that if I hang around the two, after they kill the baby, they're going to come after me too. So I decided I'm going to run out of the stable and run away. And while I was running to the back of the stable, the German soldiers started to shoot at me, okay? They started to chase me. So I ran to the door from the stable. There was a fence. I jumped over the fence, and in the back of the fence, there was an outhouse. Anybody knows what an outhouse is? It's a toilet outside, because we didn't have no toilets in the houses. Everything was outside, but big toilets. So I ran into the toilet, to the outhouse to hide, and I heard the Germans coming. I said, if I stay here, they're going to kill me. I decided, I jumped into the hole where the feces is. You know the waste? There was big holes there, and I jumped into one of those waste. I call it channel number 5, because I still smell it now. That's what it is. And I jumped into one of them, and I heard the German coming. I submerged myself completely into the feces. And they opened up the door, they didn't see anybody, you know, they left. I stayed in that hole the whole day till it got dark. When it got dark, I said, I forgot to tell you, my brother worked in the stables, and he saw what was happening. And that when he went home, he told my mother they probably killed me because they were shooting after me. And listen, my mother was crying. And at night when it got dark, I went home.